Yes, you hide, of course. Okay. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back to the Central Asia Program and Iris. Welcome, everybody. We still have 3 seats here, so please don't be shy. Come here also. So we are beginning this new academic year with a very sensitive and hot topic in terms of bilateral relationship between the U.S. and Central Asia, and we will be discussing the current state of relations between Kyrgyzstan and the U.S., especially after the cancellation by Bishkek of the treaty cooperation it had with the U.S. And I must say that's a topic that has been everywhere over the news, at least the news interested in Central Asia during the whole summer. And Sebastian has been one of the first here at the Central Asia program to try to express the fact that we should really have a specific session on that and have a team of scholars to discuss it. So I think we are very grateful to have this team on working on Kyrgyzstan. I think that the best team on Kyrgyzstan we could have in DC. So thank you so much for accepting to join us. So if I just go from the left to the right, Erika Marat, professor at the National Defense University, Eric McGlinche, professor at George Mason University, and Sean Roberts, professor here at the George Washington University. We decided to make this discussion under the form of a roundtable and not a kind of more formatted presentation, because I think what is really important is to have this kind of free discussion. So there are several questions I would like to raise and to have you discussing, and then after we will open the floor for a Q&A session. So, of course, the first question is that, I mean, it's just to have your general interpretation on this cancellation by Bishkek of the treaty cooperation. During the summer, the discussion was very much around the fact that this cancellation arrived just after the State Department gave this award to the activist Azim John Askarov. So I was wondering if you really consider that as being the key element, or if we should look at the kind of the broader picture of the U.S.-Kyrgyz relationship to try to find why Bishkek was interested or consider that it has to cancel the treaty. Mm-hmm. So, Erika, would you like to...
Sure. Thanks for having me here. So I do think that it was linked to the award. Yeah. And that's for the following reasons. First is, of course, Atambayev has never been famous for his ability to build relations with Western partners, including the United States. I think the way President sees United States and the West is as those unpredictable, arrogant superpowers who kind of want to exploit the region and the country in particular for their own purposes without considering the interests of those countries. Atambayev is rather to preserve relations with Russia, who he sees as strategic, most important partner of Kyrgyzstan, and trying to do everything not to disappoint Russia in any way. But I think the bigger problem here was, and that I know from more informal communications during my stay in Bishkek this summer, is inaptitude of the diplomatic corps, the MFA in Kyrgyzstan, their inability, their disappointment was the State Department, was their efforts to prevent this award from happening, and generally their efforts to prevent State Department and other U.S. agencies to raise the issue of Askarov, Azim John Askarov, and to link Azim John Askarov to all the other human rights abuses in the country, and not, you know, try to point at some of the achievements of Kyrgyzstan in building democracy, parliamentary democracy. But they failed to do that, and the award still happened, and the reaction was that we will choose something very symbolic. So I don't think the Kyrgyz side was actually trying to really disappoint or, you know, really cut all the ties with the United States, but they wanted to make it very symbolic and very loud, very clear that this is their reaction. And I think it was, I personally think it was an overreaction, and there was a range of other possibilities, other types of responses that they could have chosen. Unfortunately, they didn't do that. The other question maybe we'll get to discuss is, why is this award was given when it was given, and what was the message behind it? That's also, I find, to be an interesting question. But these are just my two points.
Mm-hmm. Eric, would you like to follow on that?
I think Eric has given us a lot of helpful points, and I agree with everything that Erica has said. Just a little bit more context. If you look back to the international report on the OSHA events in 2010, in the report that came out subsequently, and you look at the Atumbayeva's administration reaction, which was a rejection of the international report, a very forceful rejection of the international report, I think it's not surprising that we see a similar rejection of the State Department's awarding a SCAR of this award. I mean, nationalism is at the point in Kyrgyzstan where no single political figure that isn't Uzbek can stand silently and not react in this way. So I don't think it's any surprise that this is how the government reacted. If Rose Atumbayeva and her administration reacted the way they did following the international report after the 2010 events, it's not surprising that Atumbayeva, who is someone who is not known to be as much inclined towards the United States as the Atumbayeva administration was, reacted in the way that he did. So I don't think it's surprising by any stretch of the imagination. And we're already seeing this nationalist element coming up in the parliamentary election. So this is just in the atmosphere of Kyrgyzstan. That said, I think there's a couple other things to keep in mind. It's not just the State Department's decision that's affecting this. I mean, clearly Russia is putting a lot of pressure on Kyrgyzstan. The Eurasian Union is part of the story, and I think we have to keep that in mind. The broader question of nationalism I just talked about, I mean, it's not just a SCAR that's going on right now. I mean, you look at the Kamala case. This is all about, I mean, the charges against Kamala are ludicrous, but this is all about trumping up the bona fides of a weak Atumbayev regime by going after low-lying nationalist rewards. So, this is part of a larger narrative that's going on here. And then the last thing I will say is, I mean, who easier to go after right now in Kyrgyzstan than the United States? The opinion of the United States is at an all-time low in Kyrgyzstan. I was there this summer talking to colleagues, and part of this is missteps by the U.S. government itself, but I think part of it is also the Russian media, which pervades the entire media of Kyrgyzstan. And if you watch the Russian media, it's easy to understand why the Kyrgyz people have the view that they have towards the United States. So kicking the United States at this point is a very easy thing to do, and a very easy thing for the administration, the Atumbayev administration, to do to win credibility among the population.
Okay, what else to add? Yeah, well, I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind is also in the context of the growing nationalism is the upcoming parliamentary elections and Atumbayev's party wanting to also kind of display its nationalist chops a little bit, because as we see, all the parties in the upcoming election are aligning themselves with some sort of nationalist segment, and it's actually to the point of absurdity almost, because you have parties that, you know, like Atamaken, which appear to be running on a platform previously of pro-Western sentiments, now aligning itself with one of the biggest nationalist forces in the country, the former mayor of Osh, and you see the Respublika Party also aligning itself with Atatürk, which won a lot of seats in the first parliamentary election by promoting nationalist discussions and rhetoric in its campaign. So it seems that, you know, in the context of Kyrgyzstan's politics right now, you have to align yourself with some sort of nationalist trend. Another point, though, I just would like to bring up, I wonder to what degree also this is, it was brought up by Erica that the Kyrgyz government for a long time has been very upset about the lack of recognition of its achievements in the realm of democratization. They've been going back and forth with Freedom House and the State Department for quite some time over the position of Kyrgyzstan and the Freedom in the World Index and so on. And, you know, it's understandable where some of their gripes come, but also it's interesting because we have simultaneously a switch in U.S. foreign policy to a certain degree where I think under the Obama administration, the focus has less been on democratization and more on human rights. And in Kyrgyzstan's case, we do see a lot of achievements in terms of political democratization, but in part because of mm-hmm. this growing nationalism, we're seeing some backwards movement on rights. And so it's an interesting situation where the U.S. and Kyrgyzstan are kind of looking different directions at the same time and clashing. And I just want to throw out one kind of possible idea, which is kind of the mouse that roared scenario, where Kyrgyzstan is just trying to get the attention of the U.S. to a certain degree because they feel that the U.S. government is not at all interested mm-hmm. in Kyrgyzstan, which is justifiable because there has been a decreasing interest in Central Asia as a whole, but I think in particular in Kyrgyzstan. And to think that the Kyrgyz government has done similar things in the past. Remember the Manas-based agreements they would throw out, we're going to tear up this agreement, and then they would come back to the negotiating table and then they would come to an agreement. So, I wonder to what degree also doing this is trying to get the U.S. to come back and say, okay, let's renegotiate this bilateral agreement.
Mm-hmm. Great. So you mentioned several elements that are both kind of domestic policy and also foreign policy, and I wanted to try to kind of disentangle them a little bit. If we consider that this kind of nationalism issue that the three of you mentioned is really something that explains the decision, my point would be, what do we know from what is going on now in the country? So you mentioned the kind of nationalist agenda that many political parties are having. But I was also wondering how this conciliation treaty has been discussed and presented by the Kyrgyz government to its own domestic audience. Is that really discussed under this label of nationalism, like, okay, the U.S. are pushing for someone who is more on the Uzbek side? What this kind of narrative mm-hmm. used by the government toward mm-hmm. its own domestic audience? And if yes, in that case, that would really put this kind of nationalism agenda or issue really as being one of the drivers?
Mm-hmm. I actually disagree that it's linked to nationalism. It's more about making a point to the United States to treat Kyrgyzstan with dignity as opposed to, it's about Uzbeks. I think nationalism in general has subsided in Kyrgyzstan. People are still nationalist, but the discourse has subsided. And one example, real quick, one singer, popular pop star, couple of months ago said something really terrible. He came up with some nationalist slur. He was attacked from left and right and from everywhere. My hunch is that this political campaign season, we're not going to hear as much nationalist rhetoric as in the past because other issues are more important. But in terms of what's going on in Kyrgyzstan, I think it's important to remember the background, the informational background that Russian media creates, as Eric said. So the point here is the discussion in the media was more about, United States does provide some support, some help, but it's not really worth it to act like we're a small country. We need to act with more dignity. And, this happens against the background of Russian TV channels showing how Russia destroys foreign food and, all those cheese and detergents, you name that, washing detergents. So there is this idea that, again, United States is very arrogant and does whatever United States wants, and we need to stand up to show that we can't treat us just like a small country, and just what Sean also mentioned. And in the media, again, it wasn't really a discussion about treatment of Uzbeks or treatment of Askarov, or his trial process. It wasn't anything about that. It was more about trying to understand what are the programs, the USAID programs that are under risk, what is going to change, whether whatever is going to change will be replaced by something else, and things like that. So it's more about Kyrgyzstan-US relations as opposed to Kyrgyz-Uzbek relations inside the country.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to
continue on that? Respectfully disagree with Eric in that I think, you know, looking at the timing, I think this is a case where correlation, there's a bit of causation that goes along with it. I mean, I think the other stuff that you're talking about, Eric, I think is absolutely right, but I think this was, this certainly sparked the decision. But that said, there's a lot of contributing factors that are going on here. Eric had just mentioned some of them. The other thing that I would mention is, if you look at the portfolio of Kyrgyz receipts from the USG, what they're getting now from the USG, and then look at the timing. For a long time, money from the U.S. government was going directly to the leadership through Manas, right? So this is where the lion's share of money was coming. It had eclipsed all the programs of the 1990s, which were, by and large, good governance programs, which I think if you ask the Akayev regime how much they like these programs. Well, some of them they didn't like very much at all because this was challenging Akayev's authoritarianism. If you look at the portfolio of U.S. money going to Kyrgyzstan now, the portfolio that's going to be affected by this canceling of this treaty, by and large, these are good governance programs. These are programs that are directed towards mitigating authoritarian rule, the very rule that the Atambayev government wants to continue. So by canceling this, it actually makes it a little bit more difficult potentially for the U.S. government to renew, revitalize these programs that are directed at good governance, and makes it a little bit easier potentially for an increasingly autocratic government to stay in power.
That might be the thought process in the leadership in Kyrgyzstan, but it would be very flawed, right? Because one thing is, I think it's important to note, having worked at USAID in Central Asia for many years in the 90s, I know these bilateral agreements very well. They don't, by canceling this bilateral agreement, it does not nullify U.S. assistance, right? It's just about issues regarding the diplomatic immunities of people who work in the assistance program, and it relates to tariffs, customs tariffs, and taxation of things coming into the country for assistance programs, mostly. And generally, if you try to push back on USAID in terms of its assistance, the response may be the opposite, which is more governance projects challenging the regime and less economic assistance in other areas, health assistance, and so on. So it may be true that there's some thought process like that, but it would not be a very smart one, I think. And I just would mention, I guess, in terms of the, I think it is important to still link the idea, even the way that you're talking about nationalism, Erica, even the way you're talking about the U.S. Kyrgyz relations as opposed to U.S. or Kyrgyz Uzbek relations, it's still about nationalism, right? Because it's still about a certain pride in Kyrgyzstan and a certain dissatisfaction with the U.S. And on top of that, as both of you mentioned, with the Ukraine crisis and the Russian media, which is just, for those of you who don't watch Russian media, it's unbelievable, you know, that every problem in the world is due to the U.S. So, I mean, last night there was a whole program on how the Syrian refugee crisis in Europe is all planned by the U.S. Yeah. But, so, I think that that's still playing into that sentiment. And that's the easiest low-hanging fruit, as both of you said, is the U.S. right now.
Yeah, it's different types of nationalism.
Yeah.
So one thing I'd say is think about the counterfactual, right? If the Atambayev government was pulling down the rents that the Bakiyev government was pulling down for the base, would it have been so quick to have canceled the 1993 agreement?
No.
So what I'm saying is, because the portfolio of U.S. payments has changed so dramatically,
mm-hmm.
Can I add something? So don't treat Atambayev as a rational actor, as you know, who builds his power on rents. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. He's a more emotional person. And I think what he associated with the base is not so much rents, mm-hmm. but disappointment in U.S. for supporting Bakiyev. That's that's the legacy that the base represented after the regime change in 2010, a source of Bakiyev's support. And now getting rid of that symbol was also like kind of paying back, kind of retribution to U.S. from Kyrgyzstan's side. That's probably closer to a reality.
Yeah. Well, and I guess to find some common ground between both these points, one of the things in talking to some Kyrgyz officials about this, there is this way that they compare. They say, well, look at what the U.S. gives us, but look what Russia and China give us, right? And so there is an idea that, they look at foreign assistance as, bottom line, what are the dollars they're bringing in?
Yeah.
It may not be lining their own pockets the way that was the case in the Bakiyev administration, but it's still about bringing in budget support. And the USAID programs have never really done that. The base payments were not an assistance program. They were base payments.
To follow on that, and Erica, you mentioned a term that I think is really important, knowing how people in the region react, is this notion of dignity and wanting to be treated with dignity, and this issue of having a status and being recognized. And of course, not having a military basis anymore it can solve some geopolitical tension, but it also lower your kind of geopolitical status globally in the world. So if we try now to look on the other side, what do you think was the State Department's goal? And probably in the room here, we would have people who would know more on the decision-making, the way the U.S. Decision-making process functioned, but how do you think, what was the message sent by the State Department in awarding a prize where they would know it would create this kind of
mm-hmm.
of dignity aggression feeling in Kyrgyzstan?
So I don't have an answer for this question. I'm also curious, why is it today? Is it linked to 5 years anniversary since Osh events? Is this because there was a queue of people? Was there some sort of strong lobby behind it? I think it's a great thing that Askarov finally got this recognition, among other many recognitions in Europe and here in the United States from different NGOs, not necessarily from government. So I'm curious, what is it linked to? Because it would have been probably more important to raise it before, when the court was about to decide on his case, especially the Supreme Court. So it would have probably been more helpful to his supporters back at home. At the same time, I want to say that, again, from the MFA, Kyrgyzstan's MFA point, they blew it out of proportion. State Department Award is just, again, one of the awards. If they didn't talk about it, if they didn't notice it, I don't think people would ever find out about it in Kyrgyzstan. Just a very small group of people would find out about it. So it all looks very, unprofessional, I would say, from MFA's perspective.
I like Erica, I too am a little bit baffled by the decision, not so much that I don't think he deserved the award, but there's other cases which, from the point of view of the Uzbek population in Kyrgyzstan, are much more important, where the U.S. has been silent. So again, the ongoing Kamalov case and the trial of Imam Kamalov is, I think, something for most Uzbeks much more important. And the U.S. government has been relatively silent, if not entirely silent. So just as Eric was saying, you know, the recognition were to come at the time of the trial would have been much more effective. I think here, too, there's a screaming need for some kind of statement, and here the U.S. government's again been silent.
I have no idea why the decision was made for this award at this time, but my assumption from my experience working in the U.S. government that it was not directed to make a certain specific point at a certain time, just because that's often not how these decisions are made, right? It's more like, Eric, you were suggesting maybe specific lobby at the right time, you know, just happened to get this through. But what's interesting about that is I do think, and I found this consistently throughout the former Soviet Union, not only in Kyrgyzstan, is that the governments in these countries perceive these things as having more direction behind them, as having a more of a conspiratorial kind of approach, like this is part of some kind of message. And to highlight that, somebody told me recently from the Kyrgyz government that there was a feeling that this was meant to weaken Atambayev ahead of the parliamentary elections by making people aware that, you know, Atambayev was anti-Uzbek, and that would hence have his party lose the Uzbek vote, you know, which frankly seems way too sophisticated for like the U.S. government to have thought about, and you know, and not even clear why they would want to influence the election that way. But so I think that what might be more important than the reason for it is this difference between the fact that people in Kyrgyzstan on the ground, when they see something like that, they see that as having directionality and specific meaning, which it might not.
So to follow on that, there are two elements. I think firstly that we don't really know why this case, as you mentioned, and not another one that would have been also relevant for Kyrgyzstan, but also why giving a prize on Kyrgyzstan or for someone and not another country. And of course, seen from Kyrgyzstan, I think one of the arguments is also, why are we the one targeted, while we are also the more democratic and the more liberal? Why not a prize for an Uzbek or a Turkmen opponent jail? And there are many of them. So
that's a good point.
Yes. So I think that's a point from coming from Bishkek, which is interesting. And so I was wondering, do you think we can link it also to the fact that the U.S. policy after the closing of the Manas base, but also globally in the former Soviet Union, all this push for, I mean, because Russia reacting with the law against NGO and so on, and all this Russian law being also replicated in Central Asia, and we see on the other side the U.S. trying to push, especially on LGBT issues. In fact, that creates a kind of clash also where you can see this U.S. policy failing, especially because this LGBT issues is a kind of very difficult one. So I was wondering, do you think we can also link that to a kind of deadlock for the U.S. policy of trying, so, well, if you don't do any more security, then you do human rights, governance, and democracy. But what do you do concretely? If you want to push on Kyrgyzstan, do you push on LGBT? I mean, so I was wondering if you think that also leaks, you know, in a kind of domestic kind of evolution and what the U.S. should build. What are the channel of dialogue the U.S. State Department thinks it can have in the region?
Yeah, that's, thanks for bringing up this point. That's a very interesting point because, you know, speaking, like, jumping a little bit ahead of time and talking about upcoming elections. So it's really hard to be a politician in Kyrgyzstan these days. Life is so unpredictable, and you don't know whether you're going to be in the parliament. Probably, you know, some people are sure that they're going to be in the parliament. You don't know how many of your people will be in the parliament. Again, there is so much unpredictability about elections. How many parties are going to be in the parliament? Who will you be building with coalition? Will you be in the coalition or not? So, and that's considered to be a democracy in Kyrgyzstan. That's what a democratic process is for Kyrgyzstan. And frankly, I think, and I'm probably going to be criticized for what I say, this is the best we've got in Central Asia. This is the closest to competitive politics we've got. Other, you know, and maybe in wider post-Soviet space. And with all its imperfections, somehow the system worked for 5 years. Somehow those collectives of individuals that are also known as parties are still running for elections, and there is an element of unpredictability. So trying to survive in this unpredictable environment, a very new environment, trying to get enough supporters, and at the same time being criticized for, and I'm speaking from the perspective maybe, you know, of Atambayev's party, being criticized for issues like LGBT, which are very important issues, but very often more attention is given to them than should be, I think, because a lot of them are just happening because of, you know, just mimicking what Russia is doing. I think it's really not productive. It's more important to look at opportunities, and I think, Sean, you've been involved in some opportunities of supporting ways how you can kind of streamline the process in between elections, you know, help the parliament come up with legislature, convene roundtables with between parliament and civil society groups, help ministries to train their staffers, for instance, things like that. So I think that would be a lot more useful in the long run.
One thing I'll mention is you could take a very different perspective on this. You could like look for the silver lining, right? It's not 1993, and the U.S. position in Central Asia is completely different than mm-hmm. in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain degree, this agreement probably should be completely revamped and renegotiated. And this is a great opportunity to actually sit down mm-hmm. with the U.S. and Kyrgyzstan and say, where are our common interests? USAID has systems in place throughout the world that are much more based on bilateral discussions about
mm-hmm.
assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this in a lot of countries that are less democratic than Kyrgyzstan, you know, like in the Middle East, in Jordan, where you have cooperative agreements between the state and the U.S. government about, okay, this is what we'd like to see our assistance program look like. And I think that that would go a long way at building the relationship
mm-hmm.
between the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and Kyrgyzstan right now. And I don't think, I kind of disagree with you, Eric, about the degree of authoritarianism. Like, I mean, I think actually in Kyrgyzstan, they welcome a certain amount of governance assistance now, you know, different than any other country in Central Asia. Like, they would welcome, and they have welcomed, parliamentary assistance, like you said. You know, I mean, the parties in parliament want to figure out how do we negotiate legislation, how do we professionalize
mm-hmm.
our legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is room for assistance programs that would be both in the interest of the U.S. and in the interest of Kyrgyzstan. And if you could get both parties more invested in it through some sort of dialogue, that could have much better outcomes than what's happened in the past.
By the way, I love roundtables where lot of people don't agree, and hopefully we'll get lots more disagreement coming from the from the real experts, which many of you in the audience are. This is what I would say about Kyrgyzstan and authoritarianism. Just to step back a second and put on my political scientist hat. In the 1980s, O'Donnell and Schmitter said, "What you need for democracy is a hot family feud." We've got that in Kyrgyzstan. We've got a hot feud, a lot of people fighting each other. We have that. So that's good. Mike McFaul comes in the early 2000s and said, what you need for democracy is you need leaders to actually believe in democracy. So you need your leadership to also believe in it. You get democracy because you have Democrats in the leadership positions. I actually think you need both. And what we have in Kyrgyzstan is we have the first thing. We've got the hot family feud. But I have yet to be convinced that we have people in Kyrgyzstan. Well, actually, we have a lot of ordinary people, but we don't have leading politicians in Kyrgyzstan who actually believe in democracy. And what happens, it happened with Akayev, it happened with Bakiyev, I think it's happening with Atambayev, is these people espouse democracy before they get into power, and then they get into power, mm-hmm. and then they become autocrats. So maybe they initially believed in democracy in time one, but in time two, once they're mm-hmm. in power, there's this steady slide towards authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. So I would actually disagree and say that, I think we don't have democracy in Kyrgyzstan because we don't have this latter thing that McFaul pointed us to, which is an actual commitment by political elites themselves to the democratic system. What we do have is the initial hot family feud and a weak government that can't settle the feud, but we don't have the last component, despite a lot of push by Kyrgyz civil society for democracy. We don't have the political elite that is supporting this push for democracy.
Mm-hmm. I think it's democracy by default as opposed to by design. The parliament has shown its ability to vote on very authoritarian bills altogether, even though they were elected through competitive elections. But again, this is the best you have with the, people who were educated in the Soviet system and who only lived by certain rules. And now, again, moving towards more elections issue, there are more young faces in some political parties, not all. So it's maybe it will change, but a lot of young people also shown their talent in replicating some of the authoritarian patterns of the past. So, but again, it's a dynamic process, and I think you can call it democracy or you can call it something else.
Yeah, and I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole, although mm-hmm. it'd be very interesting to do so, about defining what is democracy.
Yeah.
But I do think that what's interesting, and in the past I've often not agreed with people trying to put forward this kind of hypothesis with regards to countries like Russia and Kazakhstan, where they say, well, but it takes a long time. It does take a long time, I think, to establish a functioning democracy. The reason I don't really buy that argument with Russia or Kazakhstan, there's not a lot of evidence that they're trying. it takes a long time, but that clock starts when you start trying. In Kyrgyzstan, I mean, I do think if you look at this objectively in terms of the time frame, there's been a lot that's happened. And if you look at American politics, before World War II, you had similar populist campaigning. I mean, and we're not even going to talk about the present election and the front runner, who's very populist, I would say. I think
nationalist.
There's a question about whether a democratic system does need some chance to mature, and whether I think some of the growing pains you also see in this is that a lot of Kyrgyz officials feel that the U.S. doesn't give them the credit for that, mm-hmm. that they don't understand mm-hmm. that yes, this is difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think that people, because of a functioning democratic system, you have this rising nationalism.
Yes.
Where you have politicians yeah. who are not, not really mm-hmm. nationalists in the sense of ethnic nationalism, trying to portray themselves as ethnic nationalists because mm-hmm. that's what sells.
That's Nick Magaron's argument in his report from a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the point of not Kyrgyz elites feeling like they are not giving credit for what they have done in such a regional environment is really a good point that explains maybe this kind of emotional, or what you could interpret as emotional. Before mm-hmm. asking you more about the forthcoming election, just one, going back to one element that Sean mentioned about kind of misinterpretation, how things are done here and how they are interpreted there. And when I think about misinterpretation, of course, I think also about the role of Russia in kind of shaping the general atmosphere in the region. And I'm kind of torn because, yes, of course, Russian media play an increasing influence everywhere in the region, especially in Kyrgyzstan. But at the same time, considering that the Russian media shape the public opinion. I mean, I always wonder what is really coming from Russia, what is just genuinely local. I mean, believing in conspiracy can be genuinely local without having to look for PRV canal to believe in it. So I wonder how all this series of misinterpretation and misunderstanding between the U.S. and the region is really linked to how Russia interpreted it, or it's not, in fact. And in that case, because for us, always considering that it's because of the Russian media, it's also kind of making our work kind of less, more easy, and also not giving the region its own autonomy. So I was wondering if you could kind of
I think it feeds on each other. I mean, it's also for instance, journalists in Kyrgyzstan. There are quite a few good journalists, but a lot of journalists rely on their own produced conspiracy theories and think that this is the way to report. I mean, I think it's Kyrgyzstan, the region, much of the world rely on those sort of local knowledge, the smarts, you know, street knowledge, neighbors' interpretation of things, as opposed to critically thinking about different events and then comparing to each other. Maybe, you know, sometimes in this country too, but I think Russian media is particularly good in feeding this public that want to believe in conspiracy theories. And very inventive and very entertaining in that sense, the way conspiracy theories are presented and how diverse they are.
Mm-hmm. They're professionally done, too. I guess maybe getting to some of what you're saying as well is that there's also some legitimate gripes that the Kyrgyz have about U.S. policy.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that one of them is this idea that the U.S. has been pushing for democratization, and they feel like, look
at Uzbekistan.
Look, we've done something. Why don't you like recognize us? Why are we, you know?
It's basically, yeah. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, you know, but why are we just like an infantile amount, you know, more free than Uzbekistan? Why is this like, you know? Why is
mm-hmm.
people not saying,
mm-hmm.
look, here's something that's happening, and why aren't they rewarding us for doing what we said said we should do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, why is it that we didn't get bitten up for kind of small things, quote unquote small things, whereas you have next door Uzbekistan that receives all sorts of military assistance without discussion of human rights and conditionalities, things like that.
I think the other thing to add here is when we talk about how good the Russian media is, and then the lack of recognition that, I mean, when you compare Kyrgyzstan to Uzbekistan, there's a huge difference, right? And that's not reflected in a lot of these indices. And I think, you know, that's a legitimate source of frustration.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we have to keep in mind is the U.S. government's outreach efforts have been pretty abysmal. The U.S. government doesn't do a very good job of representing itself, not just in Kyrgyzstan, but in the post-Soviet space in general. And could do a lot more in this regard, and just for whatever reason, either hasn't felt that this was important, or just doesn't have the appetite for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, just a simple thing like the new embassy. I mean, the number of rumors that are swirling around Kyrgyzstan about the new embassy and what are in those containers and the effect of those containers on the Kyrgyz currency, it's amazing, the conspiracies, and there's very little response by the U.S. government or an effort of outreach. So I think part of the blame has to lie at the feet of the U.S. government for just ignoring the situation.
And if we now move more toward the kind of assessing the forthcoming election, what do you consider really being at stake? I mean, what is really important and what will be really coming from this election, especially also in light with the fact, and we didn't mention it, that Kyrgyzstan entered the Eurasian Economic Union, that clearly for many migrant-related families, it has been a kind of improvement on many aspects, even if the Russian economic crisis also play more on the negative side. But still, you have now this relief for many Kyrgyz family of thinking like their people can go freely to Russia. So how all that play in the way the parties will be framed, and what is really at stake at the forthcoming election?
Yeah, I think a lot of the issues will be domestic issues in the forthcoming elections. How to grow economy, how to Yeah, how to some nationalist rhetoric, but not hopefully not against ethnic groups, but more about how to preserve Kyrgyz ethnic heritage, how to spread Kyrgyzness, how to amplify Kyrgyzness. And the question is, how many parties will be represented in the parliament? And it's really a big question. And I hope there is some kind of NGO who is conducting polls. I'm looking forward to seeing what are the results. It might well be that about 7 parties will be represented in the parliament next, and that's going to be an even more chaotic place in the parliament, despite the fact that a lot of parties merged together. How many seats will Social Democrats receive in the parliament? My personal belief is that they're aiming at the maximum of 60 seats. However, I also know that a lot of people think that they will not be able to gain that many seats. And so there is a lot of unpredictability, and I think a lot will change. There's only 1 month left till elections, but a lot can change till then. But the biggest problem I see with these elections is not even political parties, but the way they're conducted, and that voters are forced to submit biometric data. And the window of opportunity to submit this biometric data was just over a year. And considering that about 20% of population is abroad, a lot in Russia, this process has not been handled well. In Russia, there was an opportunity to submit this data in Surgut in February, and then in Moscow for a couple of weeks now. Considering that probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of Kyrgyz citizens are in Russia, I don't think it's possible to expect them to travel to Moscow, just first submit their biometrics to vote, you know, to get the right to vote, and then come back to Moscow again to actually cast their votes. And that's a huge problem for Kyrgyzstan, and I think a lot more criticism should be voiced about it.
Yeah. I would agree that the procedure of the election in many respects is more important than the ultimate outcome or the content of the election. And the biometrics thing, I think, is very important. The other thing to keep in mind is that half of the Kyrgyz population is under the age of 24. So for a lot of Kyrgyzstanis, this is going to be their first formative experience, potentially with a somewhat normal or procedurally okay election, potentially, right? So if we get that, then there can be some kind of positive acculturation to the process of elections. If we don't get that, then I think the public's view towards the parliament, towards the elections, might be adversely affected. So this is a real opportunity. If procedurally Kyrgyzstan has a relatively free and fair election, I think a lot of ground can be made. The other procedural point that I think is critically important is there are a number of initiatives, I think it was, they emerged in May, from within the parliament to exert higher party control over the members of parliament. So if an MP were to break from a party, he or she could be expelled from a party. Now, that proposal was tabled, and they haven't picked it up. But I think one thing that we have to watch very closely is if this proposal is picked up after the election. I mean, there's pros and cons to this. The pros is that this could lead to greater party unity and actual stronger parties. The con is that you could get these authoritarian practices, which you see more broadly, replicated within the parties themselves. And I think that's something that you would have fewer diverse views in the parliament.
I don't know. You know, I do think that you know, it's funny. You see now when people talk about the U.S. election that, oh, geez, pretty early. Like Erica said, I kind of feel like even though it's a month away, it's kind of early to tell what's going to happen in the Kyrgyz elections. You know, remember that people only have like a month of campaigning, so it's not clear yet if parties are going to really come out with concrete messages that will mean anything. I mean, in terms of economic development, sure, that's a fairly kind of obtuse thing to talk about. But I'd be very interested if anybody takes on corruption, because I know, having done focus groups a couple of years ago on human rights, all anybody wanted to talk about was corruption. That's the violation of their human rights. And mm-hmm. and I think that if a party emerged that really focused on that, they could really shake things up quickly. So I don't know.
Let me ask you a last question, so after we can open the floor for a discussion. Okay, so now here we are. We have no more bilateral treaty. As Sean, as you said, it doesn't mean things are stopping. Many projects may continue without the bilateral treaty, but it's also a good opportunity, as several of you mentioned. So, okay, now on which kind of foundation do both countries want to build their relationship? And so I would like you to kind of just have some ideas or suggestion on what do you think, both on the U.S. side and on the Kyrgyz side. What is really, the relationship? On what do we want to build something? Because, in fact, that's not an obvious... the question is obvious, but the answer is clearly is not. What are the share of the common grounds?
I'll be very brief. I think what the government wants is... They clearly want to continue to receive help, but they want to set conditions on how this help is delivered.
Mm-hmm. I think there's always an appetite in USAID for these good governance programs, and I think they're well-meaning. I think Erica's point about controlling this is spot on, and the Kyrgyz government is going to want to control the implementation of this. So I'm dubious about the effectiveness of these good governance programs. I think one area where the United States can make a huge difference and a quick difference and actually be effective despite Russia is in secondary education. This is an area that has been largely ignored by the U.S. government. It's an area where the U.S. government has an advantage over other players. It's also an area that is not likely to be seen by the Kyrgyz government as challenging. And if you think about it, if you look at the education, the youth, this is something that is desperately needed. Kyrgyzstan is surviving on the fumes of Soviet-trained bureaucrats. We have a whole new generation that's coming through that needs education, and this is, a real opportunity for the U.S. to make a positive difference.
I think probably the most dangerous thing would be to just allow the status quo to continue, because I think that will, it kind of reminds me of a Putin-esque strategy of frozen conflicts. If you leave, or what the Chinese used to do, and leave all their borders disputed. Like, if you leave these things kind of disputed and not resolved, then you can use it at any point to stop anything you want to stop. If I was working for the U.S. government, I would want to sit down with the Kyrgyz and say, okay, if we're going to continue assistance, let's drop a new agreement. And let's talk about what are the things that we have common interest in. And I think there would be plenty. The U.S. can also temper expectations and say, well, the truth is we can't guarantee that we're going to have huge budgets for Kyrgyzstan, but we could work with you to make sure that the money we're using is used more effectively and is done is used in ways that you want it to be used. And there's a lot of countries. Vietnam, for example, has been very good at managing international donors. There's a lot of developing countries that have figured this out, that donor organizations don't have the same. They don't have a lot of communication across lines, mm-hmm. so there's a lot of duplication, there's a lot of problems with development. One of the best ways to manage that donor coordination is the host country actually managing it. Mm-hmm. But that requires a bit of capacity on the side of the Kyrgyz
government. And granted, there is
that.
Some elements of democracy there as well.
Yeah.
And oversight.
Yeah. Yeah. In Vietnam.
Well, I think that's great to listen to you both sharing similar perspective and disagreeing on some others. So now I would like to give the floor to the room. So if you have questions, comments, please take the floor, introduce yourself. I'm sure there are plenty. Just the first one are always. Don't be shy. Yes, please.
Martyr. Ken Meyer, of course, I produce a TV show called Robots. what is the Russian media saying about the U.S. role with regard to Kyrgyzstan in particular that gives us a bad reputation there? Is it, in a general sense, is it we're meddling in our affairs, or what?
So Russian media coming from Russia doesn't really have much to say. But there was Russian media, Russian language media in Kyrgyzstan was Russian language journalists who work just as Kyrgyz or other language journalists who treat their intuition as a source of information and consider it to be good reporting. There are some strong pro-Russian, anti-Western, anti-U.S. sentiments. But
what did with regard to Kyrgyzstan? There's lots of anti-U.S. sentiment in the world.
Right.
What do they say that relates, that gets the Kyrgyzstanis or the Kyrgyz or whatever they are
excited? There was a lot of conspiracy theories regarding Manas. I'm not going to go too deeply into that. Regarding USAID workers, for instance, that they enjoy diplomatic status and they do whatever they want. And then, you know, different stories about what different USAID employees did in Kyrgyzstan, sort of thing. So how they enriched themselves, or how they just used the hospitality of the nation, things like that.
And the Okinawan complex.
And I would just add, I mean, there's, I think one of the powers of Russian propaganda outside of Russia is actually when they don't talk about things that directly impact that country, because people can sometimes still be very skeptical if they're watching Russian TV and they're spinning a conspiracy theory about Kyrgyzstan. They might see through that. But when they're talking about Syria, mm-hmm. which does impact Kyrgyzstan in the sense that there's Kyrgyz that are ending up in ISIS, and there's conspiracy theories being spun through the Russian media about how the U.S. is to blame for ISIS, and that this is essentially actually somebody from the Kyrgyz government recently said this to me, that, you know, well, I mean, didn't the U.S. aren't they really responsible for ISIS because they were supporting an anti-Assad opposition? But of course, the U.S. actually never really supported the anti-Assad opposition very much, and certainly not the people who were in ISIS. So, you know, it's those type of things that I think start to resonate. And then the things that they're saying that the U.S. is responsible for with regards to Ukraine, because Russian TV right now is about 50% about Ukraine. And so they see that and they say, oh, you know, these poor Russian minority in Ukraine that the U.S. is trying to destroy, and, you know, showing refugees and showing people who've been killed and blaming it on the U.S., that resonates with Kyrgyz as well. Mm-hmm.
One of the elements to follow on that I think was, and maybe you can either confirm or not, that seems to me important, seen from the Kyrgyz side, is everything that was related to Manas and to the big kind of financial scandals around Manas. And I think there is among the Kyrgyz public, or at least some elites, this feeling that, well, the U.S. has been largely participating in making the Bakiyev regime really corrupt. And at the same time, when all these stories became public, well, the U.S. were relatively shy in trying to be transparent about what has been their role. And so I think that, I don't know if you would confirm that it's something that is still in the narrative, that when the U.S. ask about kind of transparency, but on the Manas management, they haven't been transparent. And now that the case is open, the U.S. is not pushing very much for huge transparency also on our side. Is that something that is still that still resonates?
Well, I mean, one thing that resonates is the new government, and I think they have a legitimate gripe here, is very frustrated that they're being held accountable for financial obligations and corruption of the old government. So Asia Universal, some of these financial arrangements that the Bakiyev government incurred have now fallen on the new government, and they're pretty ticked off that they're left holding the check for a lot of this stuff. And I think there's some legitimacy for in that concern.
Mm-hmm. Bill Veal. I'm President Emeritus of the U.S. Kazakhstan Business Association. I wanted to pick up on something that Marlene was trying to get out of the panel here, and that's about the Eurasia Economic Union, but I would also like to add Kazakhstan's joining the WTO. So I'd like to kind of ask about the trade issue in terms of business-related economic activity in Kyrgyzstan, and whether there's a business-based party likely to emerge, and whether people are sort of beginning to, if you will, salivate over the trade opportunities. And this is, of course, aside from the China stuff that's been coming into Kyrgyzstan, and there's a whole new set of issues here related to the way that that's going to work. And I'm just wondering if you see the political party arrangement sorting itself out with anybody sort of taking a I'm sorry, the word Trump came into my mind. A native Trump or something of that sort, somebody who has got a Bloomberg, a business sort of oriented candidate emerging in all of this. I'll take it to any of you.
Okay. Well, just very briefly, there is a political party that tried to compete in municipal elections in Bishkek, made of young entrepreneurs, very bright, very liberal, libertarians even. They know that their chances are very slim to win nationwide elections. However, the ties that they built, the parties that they joined, really puzzled a lot of their supporters. So they joined the Tajik Republika. And they're not represented in the party lists even. They're just in the political council of that political bloc. So unfortunately, those liberal-minded young people, young individuals, are really in the margins of. But there is a political force like that, but it's in the margins of political spectrum. And by the way, the border between Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan is still pretty tough to cross. People faint because of heat, waiting in line. Kyrgyzstan is part of the. So Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan are part of two trade blocs, but the borders are still sealed.
So the facts on the ground.
Are there comments on Kazakhstan and the WTO?
I mean, I guess one of the things that this whole issue brings up is, that all the Central Asian countries, I think, want to emulate Kazakhstan's ability to balance international partners. But the Kyrgyz have so little to offer Western partners. I think the Kyrgyz, at least the Kyrgyz elite, I think a lot of them understand the pitfalls of relying too much on Russia and China, but they don't see how they can really get America that interested in Kyrgyzstan. There's not oil. They tried democracy. it's difficult for them for that reason because I think justifiably all the Central Asian states are in a difficult spot. Between a rock and a hard place, I don't know which one is the rock and which is the hard place. But in bringing in European and American interest is a challenge. And Kazakhstan's been pretty good at it, but they also have a lot of natural resources that help facilitate that.
Yes. Jackie Mahler, Center for National Policy. One of you mentioned that you thought that perhaps canceling the bilateral treaty was trying to bait the United States and bring them back to the negotiation table. But then how does it factor in that Atumbayev just canceled his trip to the United States for the elections that we know probably not?
That's a good question. He might genuinely be busy with elections and really needs to spend a lot of time on the ground. I think again, that's my personal opinion. I might be wrong. I think he wasn't able to secure high level meetings here in U.S., so he didn't see much, much necessity really to travel for that reason.
Yeah, I would follow also on that element. I think, given the context and this crisis, probably from the Kyrgyz side, this trip was considered as a great occasion of being received and put things on the table and having kind of high-level meetings. it's on the U.S. side, there was no interest in receiving Atambaev at the moment of a crisis to say, let's sit at the table. Then, of course, all these issues of dignity, prestige, and status remain very important. Why would Atambaev come if he cannot meet with really have secure high-level meetings, precisely when the U.S. say we should sit at the table? So it's also, none of us is inside the system to knowing how decisions are taken, but that's a good point, I think.
At the very least, a photo op. And I think Rahmon got one with the family, was Obama's. I think there was a photo of them. I mean, Nazarbayev did. Mm-hmm. So Atambaev did. She did. She met with Obama a few times.
And she was given a big award from the State Department, too, by Hillary Clinton.
For courage,
I think those matter a lot more than people think they do.
Yeah.
All those, you know, even just the photo ops.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
No questions?
Yes.
Katie Pest, I'm the diplomat. I have a question about the procedure of the election. So they plan on using the biometric fingerprint registration to vote. Is there a contingency plan? I mean, in terms of the technology, it could fail. That happens in places where this is more routine. There's a lot more sophisticated systems. So, and then when I look at why he canceled his U.S. trip, that's one of the things I factor in. Is like, if I was the president of Kyrgyzstan, I'd rather be there when there's a problem than here. And so what do you think, the likelihood of there being a problem, and do you think there's any contingency plan, because this could very much throw into question what should be fairly simple.
I haven't heard of any contingency plans. It's all about you either submit your biometric data and vote, or you don't do either of them. So sorry, but I think the strongest enforcer of biometric data compliance are parties themselves now who need the votes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that will skew maybe the election results in some way, because some parties will be more successful in coercing their constituents into submitting data, others will not. I think a big chunk of population will still not vote because of this impediment.
A question just for you, Eric? Are the parties given? You know, I mean, you see this in the U.S., right? Parties are the biggest registrars of voters.
Mm.
Are the parties able to facilitate that pretty easily right now?
It's informal. It's basically going, meeting with people, potential voters, villages, in urban areas. It's with Damkomy, the people who are responsible for apartment complexes, and basically telling them to move other people to submit data.
Is there resistance among the population? Because I'm thinking in the Georgia case, where similar, in the identification card, there's all these conspiracies about this kind of data, and a lot of it wasn't well received. I mean, how is the Kyrgyz population responding to?
There is a loud opposition in civil society that you can't deny the vote, the right to vote. You can't deny the right to vote because of biometrics. I don't think they've been successful in campaigning across the nation. I think it's the public, public employees, which is, I think, the majority of actual employment in rural areas, full-time employment, they were just, again, shoveled and needed mandatory to submit biometric data. President supporters probably in the population, the Social Democratic Party supporters probably submitted data. But in general, I mean, I'm very skeptical that people will submit their data just to vote.
And to follow on that, I also have a question. Can we identify a party that would really represent migrants in Russia? Because they would be the one the most affected if the migrant population in Russia is not able to vote. And do we see something where in migrant family, when men are in Russia, then women would take the lead in terms of voting? And we see that very clearly in Tajikistan, where the Islamic Rebirth Party, 40% of their members are women, not because sorry, because they are representing their husbands who are abroad, and therefore the political links, the political identity of the family is going through the woman. So do we have these kind of things, especially right. in southern Kyrgyzstan?
Yeah. So we have to remember that even in southern Kyrgyzstan, a lot of women are migrants as well. Mm-hmm. It's a really different dynamics yeah. in Kyrgyzstan than, yeah. and sometimes yeah. it's the woman who is the migrant and then the father
right.
stays, or the husband stays behind. But there are still more men, of course, traveling. There used to be Zamandash Party, so contemporary, you would French translate it, who represented, notoriously represented in the interest of the party. It was more like, it was really like, you know, horizontally organized force without a clear leader. They actually did not want to have a clear leader. That party kind of, it's still very strong, but it no longer is associated so directly with the migrant force, more with the domestic, you know, with domestic population, or, you know, people who are staying and not traveling. And this time around, the migrants will not vote. I mean, they will, because most migrants are located, like the majority of migrants are located in huge countries like Russia, United States, and China. And there is, I mean, the Kyrgyzstan as a state is just not able to service this migrant population. Even here in the United States, where migrants are more affluent than in Russia, I mean, there's a huge community in Chicago. Will they travel to Washington, D.C. and to submit their data and then come back in October? I don't think they will. And that therefore, they will not vote. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes?
Nathan Davis, I'm a master's student here at GW. Is the voting system that Kyrgyzstan uses specifically designed to discourage specific groups from voting, kind of similar to what some states have been doing here, or is it just kind of this is the system they have and inertia keeps it going?
I was very skeptical about this whole biometrics data because I thought that only supporters of Social Democratic Party and public employees will submit their biometric data. So aside from that, I don't think it's really designed to suppress any voters. I think if people do actually trust the state and submit their data, then it's really open to everyone, and it's going to make it easier to count the votes and to to address some of the practices of fraud voting. Because it did happen even in last elections that in some voting precincts people would storm by force, grab like voting boxes and run away or some do things like that. So some kind of electronic governance would help to streamline the process. And the question is, will ethnic Uzbeks submit biometrics data? So there we don't know. There are conflicting reports. One journalist, ethnic Uzbek journalist from Kyrgyzstan, told me that Uzbeks are so terrified of the state, they are submitting data, their biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want any, they're so afraid that they won't just abide the law, by the law. Whereas others say they so distrust the state, therefore they stay away from that. So we don't really know. I mean, there needs to be some research on that.
There was a question there.
So I was late because of America's own crumbling infrastructure. so if you guys repeat the first half hour all over again, if you guys have already answered this question, then feel free to ignore it. I'm Eric Boyle. I'm with ICF International. I guess U.S. and I'm really concerned about the cancellation of the bilateral agreement, not for USAID's sake, but for USAID implementers' sake. So USAID is far more than democracy. So I'm curious about the effects of the health programs, energy programs, other things that are basically life-saving in Kyrgyzstan, as well as income-generating in terms of some of the energy programs. And then USAID's implementers do far more than USAID work. I mean, some of us are businesses that actually then try to figure out how to do other sorts of work in country. So, I was hounded by the tax police in the mid-90s. It was not a pleasant experience, and there was a bilateral agreement in place. So now without the bilateral agreement, well, I guess, what sorts of ripples might this cause among kind of U.S. overall engagement with Kyrgyzstan beyond kind of USAID?
I think one of the things I mentioned earlier, I don't know if you heard this, Eric, is I think it's really important that the U.S. try to renegotiate something with the Kyrgyz, because the worst case scenario is when you don't have anything, because then all of those random tax police
visits become completely justifiable. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no clear rules, right? You know, I think it's probably high time to update that agreement anyways, but the question is whether the U.S. is focused enough on really trying to renegotiate something with the Kyrgyz on it, because I think the Kyrgyz government is just going to continue to allow U.S. aid to work there, and the U.S. will probably continue to have a presence and have projects, and it's very possible everybody just ignores this whole thing, right? But that would probably not be a good idea, because then it can be used to just muddy the water for the foreseeable future. Whereas it could be an opportunity to renegotiate and really get Kyrgyzstan more invested in U.S. assistance programs. You know, like, what are the things they really want? And maybe USAID can start to respond more to that, too.
Same question.
Do we have other questions?
Yes.
Sanjay Bekulebadiv, visiting scientists at National Institute of Health, Bethesda, Melbourne. I would have two questions, two points that I would to ladies and gentlemen to elaborate more if possible. So the first one would be the timing of this recognition of Azerbaijan Askarov, the award, and I know that I heard that it has been told already that probably any no message was intended, but it was perceived as a message, right? But and I agree on that, and it was well perceived as a message, I suppose, most importantly by the politicians of Kyrgyzstan, right or wrong. And if you assume if we assume that there was a message intended, what could that message be? And the second question is, I would like to develop my argument on this from the perspective of the geopolitical this tension between the United States and Russia, which is happening around. So from Kyrgyzstan's point of view, when it just has been watching since it was born, like not so long ago, that what happens when you play different roles in this big geopolitical game, right? And it has very strong empirical data, which it observed from the case of Georgia, from the case of, to some extent,
Ukraine,
Tajikistan, and to some extent between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and finally culminates in Ukraine. Now, if we see the Ukraine's case, now what happens is that the Ukrainians decide that this posing of process of European integration is a bottom line that we can go no longer, here is it. But it turns out that it was not bottom line by far. Now, if the Ukrainians saw what would happen afterwards, I would think that they would gladly go to the previous state and to stay in that situation until the situation gets resolved, and maybe in the future we will try again to go to the Europe. And for Kyrgyzstan as well, if we think from this point of view that this thing is happening and Kyrgyzstan closed the United States airbase, and the Russians said, listen, this is what's going to happen. And when we look from this point of view, I think if this is the case, the resigning from the agreement between Kyrgyzstan and U.S. is not a big loss, actually. But so the question is that would you consider that if this is the case, it is actually good not even for Kyrgyzstan, but for United States as well, just to avoid another hot spot in this big game.
So first, what was the message from State Department? Mm-hmm. And second is more complex.
So, I mean, let me try to address this. So I think one of the things with the great game theory is that not all the players are as cognizant of their playing in it as everyone else. So, I mean, I think one of the real realities is that the U.S. is actually not that interested in Central Asia. In fact, I would argue they have not been all that interested in Ukraine either. And the perception is that we have a lot of discussion about this great game between Russia and the U.S., where I think Russia is much more invested in that concept than the U.S. is. And that creates a lot of problems for countries on the ground, because they've been operating. And I believe that, you know, the Kyrgyz government probably does buy into this idea and does think that the U.S., everything the U.S. is doing in Kyrgyzstan relates to this competition between Russia and the U.S., where it probably doesn't very much at all. You know, there's probably some things that do, but a lot of decisions, my guess with the decision about this award is it was some people in the Human Rights Bureau of the State Department who were frustrated about various issues in Kyrgyzstan over the last couple of years, and they've been following this case, and maybe they had a special interest in this case, and they pushed forward this idea, and somebody wrote a memo, and somebody said, okay, yeah, that sounds good. And then this award was given. And there was no, you know, nobody in the White House, nobody in the National Security Council, nobody, you know, probably the Secretary of State had no idea that this was happening, or even really know who Askarov is. Yeah. And that's a difficulty, because I think I understand that people on the ground in the region actually think that there is much more intentionality in these things.
Mm-hmm. And also the question is, of course, how much pressure does Russia really exert on the Donbass? I mean, Russian government is present, is omnipresent inside Kyrgyz government. They attend all the security councils meetings. They have full access to whatever classified information you have, and that's confirmed by MPs personally. And then that actually was written in some media outlets as well. So Russia is really controlling, in a way, a lot of actions of Kyrgyz government. You know, there are some people, some supporters of Atambayev think that what Atambayev is actually doing is he's balancing against this pressure. Whereas others think that it's the opposite, that he's so infatuated by Putin as a personality that he is just ready to, you know, do everything not to compromise his close relations with him.
One thing that I would add is that Sean's point about intentionality in the U.S. government, I think, is one that Kyrgyz would do well to keep in mind. I mean, we make the same mistake with the Kyrgyz government. We assume there's this power vertical, but in reality, there isn't. So too with the U.S. government, reading intentionality when, in fact, there's so many different actors. I think that's a mistake that we have to avoid. As far as the great game, though, I mean, the one thing that I would add that hasn't been mentioned yet is the game is not with the United States is a bystander watching the game. The game is, if there is a game, is between China and Russia, and I think that's the one that we want to be watching. Right now, the two seem to be able to coexist fairly well. Russia is using the United States in its great game to exert geopolitical power within Kyrgyzstan and Central Asia. We're a convenient thing for Russia to use, but we're just a kind of a tool in this game. We're being played by Russia. I think what we should be looking at is this new Silk Belt that China is proponing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the amount of money that's coming mm-hmm. in. One would anticipate somewhere down the road that the economic influence of China is going to run up against the geopolitical influence of Russia, and that's when the game's really going to begin. And it will still be a bystander to that game, but I think that's the game to watch.
Well, on that, yeah.
Thank you, Marvin. I'm from the Embassy of Kazakhstan. My name is Tavdat. So sort of from my English, but I tried to explain. So regarding Eric, your comment about the ethnic nationalism in Kyrgyzstan, I understand that you speak about the conflict which happened between the Kyrgyz and the Uzbeks in Osh or Fergana. I think it's in such situation is not correct to speak to say about the nationalism in Kyrgyzstan. Why? Because Kyrgyz and Uzbeks, they have a very long history of peaceful coexistence. But what happened? It because it happened maybe because of the poverty. Because we know the situation in Fergana Valley. The people who live there, most of them are farmers, and they are fighting to each other for the maybe water resources, for the pieces of land. Mm-hmm. But reason is not the nationalism between mm-hmm. them. Maybe they don't have any arguments in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean, you said that America does not have any interest to Central Asia. But
not much. Not no interest. They obviously have some.
Yes, but what we listen here in America, that both Republicans and Democrats, they say about the American leadership
mm-hmm.
in all the world. So if America wants to play keep this leadership, I think that America must play much more active role.
Mm-hmm.
In Central Asia, maybe in Central and or South Asia, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So we can maybe we can criticize the regime of Akayev or regime of Bakiyev or now Atambayev, but what we need to understand that it's not smart to speak about the to talk about the democracy with people, with the individual who is hungry and angry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do they need from assistance from USA? The real assistance to the real economic,
mm-hmm.
to the creation yeah. of the middle class.
So that would be a good point, maybe for some concluding remarks on these socio-economic factors mm-hmm. are being a key ones that tend to be sometimes overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Talk out first. I owe you an email. I apologize. It was the first week of the seminars, and that's why I haven't replied yet. And I think you're right. This last point, which is actually more directed at Sean than me, but I'll bandwagon on regardless. It's hard to talk about democracy with a population that is hungry and insecure. There is a population in Central Asia that isn't hungry and insecure. That would be the Kazakh population. So perhaps now is the time to talk about democracy in Kazakhstan. And you'll notice that we haven't we haven't criticized yet the Nazarbayev government. So, but no. So your point about nationalism, I think I agree and disagree. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Talgat, that when you dig deep with nationalism or even ethnic tension, if you look at ethnic tension here in the United States, at its core you'll often find economic causes. And if you remove those economic causes, then you won't have it. That said, I do disagree with your characterization of the Uzbek-Kyrgyz relationship as a relationship that has long peaceful coexistence. If you, and I don't want to dive too deep into the weeds, but if you look at the Brezhnev period in Kyrgyzstan, and this is where we begin to see the change. The indigenization of political posts in southern Kyrgyzstan really took off under Brezhnev. The Osh landscape really began to change under Brezhnev. You have the mayor of Osh saying, look, we got to, with this discussion of changing the Uzbek neighborhoods, that's something that we can trace back to the 70s. Certainly the 80s, and this is something that's been on the mind of the Uzbek population for a long time. We had the conflict in 1990, right? And then we had the conflict in 2010. But we also have a lot of low-level conflicts that have been going on continuously. I think there is a long period of tension between these populations. You're right that when economic times are good, this tension subsides and you see a lot of cooperation. But if you add that spark of the economics, particularly when you see one population having most of the economic resources, the Uzbeks, and then another population having all the political resources, that is the Kyrgyz, then I think you have a situation that's going to be tense, and it will remain tense until that disparity is resolved. And just to add to that, I think the other thing that's been happening both around that conflict in 2010 and since is that certain political forces have been exploiting that tension. I think that it's, there's never an ethnic relationship that's not, you know, that is at its core a problem. You know, that's not the conflict. The conflict's always driven by other things, but people often exploit ethnic difference as a way to motivate that conflict. And I think that that's what has been happening somewhat in Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great way to conclude. Just two short elements that to conclude on that. One is a kind of joke. I mean, the more I was listening to you and this kind of diplomatic crisis that we see now between Kyrgyzstan and the U.S., the more I was making a parallel with, you know, plane crash. Because, in fact, that's more or less like when a plane crash. You never have one explanation. You always have you need to factor several elements. If you just have one issue, you don't have these elements. You have both a long-term element, short-term. You have human personal, human capital issues. You have structural issues. You have intentionality. You have misinterpretation, and all arrive at the same time. And my second conclusion is that this roundtable format, I think, was really the best way we could have you kind of sharing your agreement and disagreement and factoring all these different elements, and that really give a kind of richer picture on how the things on both sides are diverse and so on. So I would like to thank you for finding the time to be here at this beginning of this academic year, and thank you everybody for joining us today. We will have several other events forthcoming. On the 15th of September, we will have an event on WTO and Kazakhstan entry. On the 22nd, we will have an event on Iran and its place in the region in the light of its possible reintegration into the regional game. The same week, from the 22nd to the 28th, we will have the week of Uzbek cinema that we are doing with the Uzbek embassy. And mid-October is a big date for us. From the 15th to the 18th here at GW, we will be hosting the Central Eurasian Studies Society. So three full days, for Thursday lunchtime to Sunday lunchtime, 70 panel, 250 speakers, among them our three speakers of today. So we hope you will be joining us very often at this beginning of the semester. And please join me in thanking our three speakers for today. I will come back on
It's very now, very well. I'm running now to make it to the best time. How are you?
That's great.
Yeah.